All right. Hello.
Hello, okay, everybody.
We are on.
We're on.
I didn't check and see how many views we got on YouTube, but I think I did put it up there last week.
Okay, so. We should post the link on Facebook or any social media just so it's out there.
Yeah.
Up to
I'm
you.
Not always. I will do that. I wasn't saying yes. I thought it was a bad idea. I was saying yes of my follow through.
Have you seen the new thing I've been doing? I don't know if you follow us on Facebook, but I've started to, in the same way that individuals have memories, the Sci-Fi Christian organization has memories. So I've just been reposting random old episodes.
Yeah, I don't approve of phrases like way back Wednesday and throwback Thursday.
Yes, I was trying to come up with a lot of alliteration. That's the only W I could come up with, and that was even a stretch. Do you have any W alliterations that would work?
No, I just don't approve of those internet-y phrases in general, but I think that as far as they go, it was fine.
I like Timeless Tuesday. I think that's my favorite. But, yes. So, listeners, if you're hearing this, go check out our Facebook page, because then you can get transported back in time to listen to an old episode. Why not?
Exciting.
Yeah.
All right, should we... Are we ready to hit it? Can you do it? I'll do the number, or I'll do the music.
Yep. You got it. You hit the music. Here we go. Episode 1180. There's Something About Severance, Season 2, Episode 8. Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Ben Anderson.
I am Ben DiBono. We're back. And for the first time in our... Oh, I brought it down too fast.
That's all right.
For the first time in our Severance discussion history, I think we're going to disagree about this episode. I thought it was... And I've watched it twice, per usual. I liked it a lot the first time. Rewatched it last night. I think this episode is phenomenal. I think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, of filmmaking. We've said this about other franchises or series where maybe everything's good, but one thing is less good. So it, by default, it becomes the worst, even though it's
If you're gonna rank all 17 episodes so far, one of them has to be the bottom.
Right.
But I have not had a single episode of Severance I've disliked.
Yes.
And I think you dislike this episode.
Yeah, I think I want to get a little bit of negative out of the way, because I'm very much looking forward to hearing why you love it. And like, I love Severance, so I want to learn more about why this episode stuck out to you as, because you described it as brilliant. Let me just get a few complaints out of the way, although I don't have a whole list of critiques, just some general thoughts.
And you're not the only one who feels this way.
That's good to know.
A very divided opinion, not... Like, there's some episodes of TV where the audience as a whole kind of, everyone thinks this was great, everybody thinks it was bad, everyone thinks it was so-so. This episode has had a very divided opinion between people in my camp and people in what I think you're about to describe as your camp. So it's strong reactions.
I'm such a big fan of Severance. I feel like I would give this episode grace in the sense that they've proven, the showrunners, the creators, the writers... They've proven themselves to us, so I don't want to like come down hard on this, but I'll just give you some general thoughts of why this one wasn't a winner for me.
Okay.
All right, here we go. Thought number one. In general, I would say Harmony Cobell is not my favorite character. So to have a whole entire episode revolving around her wasn't my cup of tea. If you look at her, of course she's a good villain, but she's good when she's like sprinkled in alongside of the heroes or the protagonist that we enjoy. To just be following just her story and nothing else just felt off to me. The fact that we had nothing, like if we had her story happening, but then we also go and check out what's happening on the severed floor, I feel like that could have been better. But we, for the first time, have no appearances by any of the characters that we actually care about and want to follow through on. I do understand that we found out valuable pieces of information to the overall mythology here. So I'm not saying it was a pointless episode. It definitely wasn't a filler episode. But and I can also see that they're trying something different here, a little bit experimental, even within a show that's experimental. It just, if you even right from the beginning, as you think of no opening credits or opening theme song, just a quick flash of Severance on the screen, sort of cinematic. We've seen this in movies before.
Very much so. Yeah.
So I can see that they're trying something different, and I'm on board with experimenting. This one just didn't work for me. So I would say, although I love the show Severance, and every episode of season one, I can't think of it. There's none that are bad. All of season two, I've liked every single episode until, I will say, I left that episode. And one of the first things I think I did after seeing it was send you just an ambiguous thumbs down emoji.
Which, eventually...
That was my first reaction.
So I think I sent you back a question mark.
Yeah.
Because I was so on a different page. You and I often send each other an ambiguous message because we're not sure what each other... When we watch it, we don't want to spoil. Yeah. I was so not on the same page with you on this episode that didn't even register to me until hours later that you were probably voicing displeasure about the episode.
I'll just quickly wrap up my thoughts with a few other things. The episode seemed a tiny bit meandering. I felt like, and I'm not saying that this is what they should have done, but let me just set the stage. Like, I'm going to paint this picture for you. What if at the end of every episode of season two so far, we've had this little epilogue, a few minutes just seeing what's going on with Miss Cobell next, and we just get a little pieces of this mixed along. This felt like, yes, there's valuable information for sure. I mean, specifically around the creation of Severance. But
yes.
But to have everything just there in this small town with a bunch of characters we don't know, with like conversations that are a tiny bit hard to follow because we're trying to just put things together as it's happening. Yeah, I think I just left there feeling like, I think I was unsatisfied, although maybe in hindsight, this will be end up being a great episode that we're going to look back on and think, wow, we really needed that. For now, it felt like they could have plugged in a lot of these scenes into an episode that was full of other things that we cared about.
And there's two reasons why I think they didn't. One of them is artistic, which I want to defend throughout our discussion.
I can totally see that.
But there's a pragmatic reason, which is that Patricia Arquette is one of the bigger names in the show. And she, you know, big names like that, same thing with like Christopher Walken, they get paid per episode that they're in.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
So there's a budgetary reason. So there's a pragmatic reason for that. And honestly, after my first viewing, I was relatively sympathetic to that perspective of maybe this should have been put budget aside, you know, ideal world. You just sprinkle this throughout. After my second viewing, I no longer agree with that opinion. So that's number one. Number two, one of the things that you can always console yourself with is that if you truly hate this episode, which is not what I hear you saying, I hear you saying you're mixed on it, but I don't even hear you saying you think it's necessarily a bad episode, that it didn't hit you the way Severance normally does.
Exactly. It's not badly done, but I'm looking at a show that I think is possibly on the list to make it into
like... Yeah, you have a high standard for it.
Yeah, I think this might be in my top five favorite shows of all time, depending on how it wraps up.
Right, right. No, I get that. I that was one of the things I was curious to hear from you. Like, I wanted to poke at, like, is this an episode that didn't quite click with you, or are you saying it's a bad episode? Because, like, if you or anyone else is saying it's a bad episode, I'll go to the mat to defend it. This is an incredibly filmed and executed episode. And so people who are like, well, nothing happened. Like, if you'd come on here and just said, nothing happened and that's my complaint, like, I had, like, a mental list of arguments to shoot that down with. Mm-hmm. But I don't hear you say that. So we're in the neighborhood where we're enough on the same page where we can discuss.
Right.
And now I lost my train of thought for where I was going.
I had brought up the idea of, could this have been sprinkled in around throughout the season?
So the other thing you can console yourself with, you and anyone else who maybe didn't like this episode, last season we had 9 episodes. So could be your bonus episode if you really don't like it.
I know you loved it. So I want to hear more about why. But in the old days of TV, when you had to have 25 episodes, everything had filler episodes. I'm not saying this is a filler episode, but in the days now that we're living with shorter seasons, it's borderline filler episode.
So that's the first thing you've said that I don't I think I would actually strongly disagree with.
You know, another thing is, just two other thoughts that are just coming to me as we're talking.
Yep.
We just did the gym episode, which was amazing. But again, it's another one that really isn't focused on our main characters. I just wonder, placement-wise, should those have been spread out? Or is there a reason for us to want, like, do the showrunners want us to feel a separation from the main characters for some reason? Because I think it'd be unusual for your lead cast to not appear for two consecutive episodes. Of course, Mark has been around in the last episode, but this one only over the phone. What were we going to say?
That's probably the one argument where I'm not going to say, yeah, I agree with it, but I'll say, let's see what the whole vision is. But
yeah,
there is a pacing argument that I do think has some merit for the pacing of the season.
Yeah.
Should they have done two side episodes, not side as in unimportant, but side as in away from the main track back to back. I think there's a valid question to be had there. So before I talk about the content of the episode, I want to give you my meta level, like why this resonated with me so much beyond just any of the content of the actual episode. So I've mentioned Twin Peaks a number of times in this, and Twin Peaks, The Return, I love the whole show, but in addition to the show itself, I love the experience of watching it. And what I mean by that is that when The Return was on live, you know, 18 episodes, and every single week, there was this sense of, I have no idea what we're going to get. It could be anything. You know, we're going to end an episode with a guy sweeping for 5 minutes. We're going to have this weird black and white episode in the middle of the season that feels more like 2001. You know, it's like early on in the return, everybody was antsy about Dougie Jones because we wanted Cooper back. And then, you know, eventually you just sort of roll with it. And it was this incredible viewing experience of just putting aside my own wants and expectations as a viewer and just being like, all right, David Lynch, whatever you want, I'm here for. If you want to have a whole episode of the guy sweeping, I'm just here for it. And it finally clicked for me about 10, 15 minutes into this episode that no other show has made me feel that way until season 2 of Severance. Not to take anything away from season 1, but this season of Severance is the first time since Twin Peaks, The Return, that I have ever had that feeling of, I have no clue what next week is going to be, but I'm just totally on board with it.
Yeah, I agree with
totally on board with it.
Right.
So I love that. I think that, though, to talk about the content of this episode is the opposite of filler. And here's what I mean by that. This episode contextualizes and recontextualizes almost everything that we have seen on this show to date. And I'm not just talking about the mythology drops. I mean, those are great. Like, obviously, Cabell invented Severance. That's huge. But more thematically than that. So I just wrote down a handful of contrasts that I see. You know, and the first one is, like, when we think about Severance, part of the charm is this very sterile corporate, facade that is hiding the mask of something we know is deeply evil with the Kier cult and Lumen as a whole. And this episode, like, the way this town is shot, it feels very real. I don't know if you've ever driven, like for me, the comparison point was driving through reservation areas in South Dakota or something. If you've ever driven in that part of the country, you see like this poverty that your brain just can't wrap its head around. Like, just there's a level of devastation. People live here and you can't quite put your head around it. And this town caught that, a very different feel, of course, being a coastal city and everything, but it caught that feel for me. And it's in such sharp contrast to the rest of the show while still fitting the overall aesthetic. And it's the second viewing is when it clicked for me. This is what happens in Lumen's wake. So what we're seeing with all of the clean, glitzy exterior, that's the facade. Lumen rolls through. This, or some version of it, is the future for all of the people who are Lumen's victims in the town of Kier, all the people that we're watching. This is what happens when Lumen has its way with a place. It's like the life is just sucked out of it. That was fantastic to me. We've all enjoyed Miss Wong this season. You know, why are you a child? It's been so funny. Suddenly, this thing that's been so funny and weird and quirky and unsettling, like, got deeply tragic in this episode. Because who is Miss Wong? She's a child. Full stop. Why? Because the Lumen cult uses children as child labor. And the whole Wintertide thing, which, by the way, hats off to you. I think that's completely confirmed, or as close to being confirmed as we have now, that it's essentially the Hitler Youth. You know, that basically got confirmed this week. I was going in a different direction than you were. So you were spot on. But no, like, and I guess they could still throw a curveball with Miss Wong, but all of our theories, oh, she's severed, you know, she's another Gemma, she's whatever. No, she's just a child. Because that's what this cult does, is exploits children. And so, like, the whole thing, like, this whole conversation that Cobell and Hampton are having outside the factory, which you really have to watch twice to get. Like, there's a whole backstory that's being given to us, but not through an exposition dump, but by being putting together the pieces of this conversation and reading between the lines and context and everything. And you realize, like, both of these people were victims of child labor. And it even goes a step further. Like, why did Cobell create Severance? It was to deal with the pain she was experiencing as being an exploited and abused child by this cult. It's like, oh, suddenly all those quirky, funny elements are still quirky and funny, and they work on a satirical level. But, like, this got dark and this got unsettling. So you have that contrast.
Yeah, after just one viewing, I did not put that together. Of course, I understood that she created Severance, but I didn't understand her motivation until you just made it plain for me.
Yeah, and, like, you really see it even in the Ether stuff, which is this version of Severance, you know, kind of Severance V1, if you will, of Ether. It doesn't sever people, but it takes away the pain. And so it's like the addiction that this town is now dealing with as a result of the pain and suffering that Lumen and the Kier cult inflicted on them. And, you know, that whatever this factory was, they refer to it as an ether factory at one point. But Cobell and Hampton and the other victims of it are escaping into drugs. And you remember what Cobell says? She says, "I haven't used this since I was 8. These are children using drugs to escape the misery of their existence. That's what's going on here. And so this is like full mask off Lumen in a way we haven't seen yet. I also, another contrast that I really, really appreciated. Like, up until this point, we've talked about the Kier cult in terms of Mormonism and Scientology, but it's really been presented to us as sort of a techno corporate cult. Obviously, they're doing this high tech severance chip and everything, and it's a corporate satire. I really like that in this episode, they again mask off. You have this folk pagan religion behind it. The fact that Sissy's house doesn't have electricity is such a wonderful, wonderful feature. Though she has a phone somehow, but she doesn't have electricity. Quick aside, the cinematography in this episode, the scene when Hampton comes in holding the lantern, is so well shot. It reminded me of Barry Lyndon with the candlelit scenes and everything in that. I don't know for sure that it was with that same rigor, but it had that feel of it to me, of like you're watching something you don't usually see with cinematography. The second time through, I was pausing and rewinding when Cobell is going through Sissy's room looking for the key, because there's all this weird stuff. Of course, you have the little idol figurine things of the four tempers. And then you have like these banners up, and it really brought in kind of a midsummer vibe to me, Wicker Man type thing of the folk cult. And so to me, the biggest takeaway of this, and I want to go through a lot of stuff from the episode, keep an eye on the clock, of course, because I know you have a hard stop, but a lot of what this brought in was this feel of we're now watching behind the scenes of the nonsense that the Lumen cult puts out there. And what you see is just devastating. Okay. So very, very rich from that perspective.
No, we've been calling it the Lumen cult, but do we know for sure if they're in this world? Does it exist as a viable religion? Or it seems pretty powerful and widespread.
I think that Sissy's dialogue seems to indicate that it is Sissy's not a Lumen employee. She is a follower of the Nine. Sissy's
a great character.
No. Well, there's a theory on it. Like, there's been 8 Lumen CEOs, the Egan family.
Okay, yeah.
And so maybe the ninth is like some promised one. I don't know. You know, we'll see how all that goes. But, you know, that's, again, it's like, this is the cult without the company, you know, and that to me was really, really good. Another great thing thematically that this did, and I'm jumping around a little bit in the episode, but and I didn't catch this at first, but you have the whole, let me back up. This season especially has really been playing with the theme of grief as something that humans naturally want to avoid, hence Severance. We already put those pieces together with this episode, but that grief is also the catalyst for growth. Like, we talked about that a little bit in light of the last episode of like the suffering is the catalyst for growth. And that was like the quote I read at the end of last episode from the death of Ivan Ilyich, is that suffering is where human transformation occurs. And that's a really deep and profound idea. And this episode had the show go there in a way that it has danced around, but hasn't hit on quite as much. And it's hard to catch. It's very, very subtle in the episode. So we, of course, have the scene where Cobell goes up to her mother's room, and there's like this ye old timey iron lung, you know, respiratory machine, which I love that the technology's even older than that. Remind me to come back to the technology. I have a thought on that. But one of the things I didn't notice at first, or noticed and didn't register, is that there's a decanter there that has liquid in it, has ether in it.
Hmm.
And so Cobell's mother, as she's going through her final suffering, is also having ether, which we know is used as an escape from pain and suffering. But what does her mother do? She removes the tube at the end, and Cobell learns that at that point, that where Cobell made a choice to not only first use ether, but then invent severance to escape her suffering and numb herself to that, her mother, who we learn rejected the Egan cult, was not a member of the cult, made the opposite decision. And that's a catalyst moment for Cobell as a character, but it's also a thematically catalyst moment for the show as a whole to throw down the gauntlet and say, this is the contrast the show is putting out there between two ways of existing in the world. One where it is about the avoidance of suffering because it sucks, and one is about the embracing of suffering because that's what it means to be human. And that is the clearest we have gotten that message in this show. And it's incredible. It's just incredible.
Yeah. Man, I love how you're putting this together. Watching it twice, watching every episode twice has really paid off for you.
Especially these last 2 weeks. You know, especially these last 2 weeks, because they've been such unique episodes with that. So the thing about technology I was going to say is that we've commented a lot about how the technological ambiguity of the show. And I've said that, like, I don't think it's a clue that the cars are old and they have smartphones. It's just part of the aesthetic of the show. And I still think that, but with maybe an added bit, a little bit added onto it. So here's what I would add onto it after this episode. In this episode, nothing about the cars feels out of place. Like, everything fits, you know? And so it's just driving home the devastation that Lumen not only wrecked this town, it left it in the past, you know? And so that's something for, you know, I think that that's thematically rich as well. And one other thing that's really good is the opening shot of the episode is of these waves coming in and, you know, going over the rocks, which I don't want, before I say what I'm about to say next, when you're watching a show like this or a David Lynch movie or something, it's always a mistake to be like, this is what that means, full stop, everyone else get out of the pool. Like, that's just a powerful image. And I think that the most important thing when people are watching a show like this is just let that resonate with you and provoke whatever thoughts it provokes. Okay. That said, what are we looking at? Well, we know from the next shot that we are looking at a cold harbor, right? Okay. So,
yeah. So what does that mean to you?
Well, that shot recurs one other time in the episode.
Yeah, during the whale scene.
During the whale scene?
When she's laying in bed and she's kind of moaning or weeping.
Oh, W-A-I. I went W-H-A, like Moby Dick.
No, that is what I'm saying. You see, okay. Her cries sounded like the call of a whale to me.
Yeah.
Did you not pick up on that?
No, I didn't, but I'll go with it. Oh, yeah, the whale scene.
You got to listen.
Yeah.
I'm talking about when she has the tube in her mouth and she's crying.
Yep.
The waves again. Whale.
Because that's the moment of her suffering. Like, she's experiencing this suffering she's put aside for so long. I don't want to say we know, but we strongly suspect that whatever Cold Harbor winds up being, it's going to have something to do with suffering. And so the symbolism of a Cold Harbor bringing Cobell's suffering home to her is really just fantastic.
Hey, okay, before you move on, I see you're looking at all your notes. Let me just ask you something else. Or I'll bring up something you talked with me about off the air. So in this episode, we've been talking about the nine and are they the CEOs? Well, you found out through somebody online that the outfits that Gemma was wearing reflect back on some of the past CEOs. Yes. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I don't know what it means, but yes. So they had the whole thing in Chikai Bardo where Gemma has to put on different outfits to go to different rooms, and she's dressed in ways that look like, you know, some of the pictures we've seen of the previous CEOs and or women of Lumen. I have no idea what that means. I think it means something, but I just love that detail.
Yeah, it's interesting. You seem to indicate offline that you thought it had something to do with more of the resurrection technology.
Probably. But I don't know. Like, there's a part of me that, like, I'm enjoying all the theorizing, but there's a part of me that's just, just go with whatever it is. Who cares? Mm-hmm. They're going to pull a David Lynch and it's going to end with somebody screaming and that'll be the last shot without any explanation.
You know, speaking of the last shot, during their official podcast this week, Jimmy Kimmel was a guest and he's a well-known Lost fan. And so he said that at some point in the middle of the show, the showrunners said, we do know how it's going to end. And if you want, we'll write it down on an envelope that you can open when the show's complete. But he was worried that he wouldn't be able to keep himself from opening it. So he decided not to do it. But they would later reveal that I don't know the details of the story, but basically they did have the last shot in mind years earlier. So while he's on the podcast, he asked Ben Stiller, do you know how the show ends? And Ben Stiller said, yes, we know how it ends, but the journey to get there, it's a little bit up for grabs.
Yeah. Which feels right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it'll be like Lost, where the first shot mirrors the last one. Helly on a table.
Who are you? No,
who are you?
Yeah.
Okay, so I've covered a lot of my notes, but let me just kind of hit on things throughout this. So we have the whole, I really like when she first goes into the diner with Hampton. And Cobell says, the town is older than I remember, frailer. Then his response is this, obviously not his words, but this recited corporate jargon from Lumen. Like, the disdain that all of these people in this town have for Lumen, except for Sissy, is just palpable. And then the fact that they all hate Sissy is also great. One of the things that's really interesting that I don't know quite what to think of, but I have a little bit of a theory of, is they refer to the mill as an ether mill, and it's implied, not implied, but as stated without somebody coming right out and saying property of Lumen, that this was a Lumen-run mill that the children were working at. But then Sissy also indicates that there's a prohibition on, using using ether, or seems to imply she doesn't use it, Kier doesn't approve of it, that type of thing. I forget exactly what she says. And then pair that with Cabell's comment about how she hasn't used ether since she was 8, which seems to be about the time she would have been recruited into advancement in the Lumen cult. Like, is there something where we're going to make this drug, but it's not for those on the inside? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's fantastic. We know that ether, in addition to the addiction, it also is causing lungs problems. We see that with Hampton has a line of dialogue about that. We have the one lady who's sitting there with the oxygen, breathing apparatus on. So it's not good for them. One of the things I loved when we get to Sissy's house is, in addition to the lack of electricity, is the way her dialogue is shifted. We've gotten like tastes of this a little bit with some of the other characters, but she's using woe a lot in dialogue. Like, you really get the sense that this is somebody who has lived. She is as fully immersed into whatever this thing is as mm-hmm. anyone else is. And she says so many weird things that are just without context that I love, because they are things that we could just sink our teeth into. So she says about Cobell's mother's room, "That room stays shut until all who remember her sit with Kier."
Yeah, why?
What? Yeah. Right, why? What's that about the religion? We have our little idols in her room. I'll send you the picture I was talking about at the banner that I see up there. It kind of has like a folklore mythology. There's a tree in it. There seems to be kind of a, not a satyr, but more of like a angelic type of creature behind it. It feels very pagan. And I think that's all very much intentional. And then she says also about her sister, "If only she had been a believer, perhaps she would have found solace in the nine." So that's the quote I was referring mm-hmm. to earlier.
I thought there was another.
All great.
I thought there was something about her house being near the nine or something like that. Is it something like her Cobell's friend from the diner? I thought he said something about she's out by the nine or something like that.
I don't recall that line.
I might be remembering that wrong.
So Sissy's dialogue, though, I want to park on that for just a second, because this is another great thing that recontextualizes other parts of the show. We've seen other characters, notably the Lumen employees, Milchick, Natalie, Helena, Drummond, all slip into what we might call Lumen speak, which is it sort of felt like a version of corporate dialogue, corporate jargon and all of that. And I think that it is functioning as a satire of that to some degree. But I think that we get an added layer to that in the character of Sissy, and that we see, no, she's not part of the corporation, but she's fully immersed in this as well. It's the cult-like aspect more than anything else. And what's great about that is that one of the implications you can tease out of this episode is that everyone else we've seen, Milchick, Natalie, who's a true believer, I think this is heavily implied, and I'm going to go with it until I were told otherwise, all of them come from a town like Salt's Neck. Like, these stories are all over the place, everywhere. Towns like this that have had the Kier cult run through, they're recruiting children. Milchick was likely a child as well who got sucked up into the Kier cult. All of Drummond, all of these guys. Maybe that's why Drummond is calling Egan father.
The city that Mark lives in is called Kier, and this one's not. So it seems like this one's unique and maybe special. Do you agree with that?
I don't. I think that, yes, it's called Kier in that it's the headquarters of Lumen, but we've already seen in the early part of this season that Lumen has offices all over the place. And I think the implication that they are recruiting children, that's one of the biggest revelations here, is that it gives us context for Miss Wong. But by extension, it also is giving us context for Milchick at all, in that these are children who were put through the Wintertide Fellowship or Redoctrination Camp or whatever it is. And we don't know exactly what Wintertide is. It's implied it's more of an advanced type of thing. But the, why is somebody like Milchick so different than somebody like Mark? It's not that Milchick got promoted. It's that his backstory is something like what we're seeing in this episode. That's why I said this episode gives context to the whole show.
Why do you think that there's an animosity between Milchick and Miss Wong then?
There could be a, I don't think we have the full picture on that. I think that we, I think maybe in the same way that there's animosity between Cobell and Milchick, like if part of what the Cure cult, and I'm speculating here, but if part of what the Cure cult is doing is encouraging the suppression of negative emotions, that it would make sense that those are filtering out in other directions. And so you can't have your standard corporate rivalry. So you have to, it has to come out through side jabs and animosity the way that we're seeing. That's kind of what I think is going on.
Yeah. It seems like he would pity her, not be mad at her, but he seems annoyed by her.
I think that they, yeah. And that's kind of what I'm seeing in all of these characters is that there's a lack of pity for each other. There's a lack of anything that would resemble, you know, they're supposed to suppress all negative emotions. The only ones that come out are the ones that are strongest enough to get through the indoctrination, which is anger, resentment, hatred, all of that. I mean, it's speculation, but that's kind of what I think they're going for. I love the discovery. And, okay, I'm going to go out on a limb. I could be reading way, way, way too much into the symbolism of where they find the yearbook and the notes and everything. Well, the symbolism of the notes themselves being in the head of Jay Meegan is, you know, great. Like she's stealing her work back out of his head. In addition to it being placed roughly where the Severance, you know, chip would be. So
that's a great point too. Yes, I love that.
Yes, it's so good. But I'm going to say that what we're seeing is a reverse Plato's cave. So if Plato's cave is, you know, the fake world, and then you have to go outside to see reality, here we have all the fake stuff out here, and it's in reality is where the truth is. So I think they're playing, I think it's intentional that the notes are hidden inside a cave, and she has to get that there. I love the grief that Cobell is experiencing as she's going, like she stops and looks at this notebook and it's a small moment. It's not, or the yearbook, it's not what she's looking for, but it's like, again, after her moment, the whale scene, like Cobell is experiencing all this suppressed grief and emotion from her childhood for the first time. And we're watching it play out. It's just incredible.
Were there any clues or interesting tidbits that you saw in the yearbook?
No. And I haven't seen, you know, usually if there's something really good, people will post it online. I did see something that, like, there's a few Easter eggs. If you pause as she's flipping through, like, her scientific notes, that there's something about goats in there or something like that. But I'm sure I let Reddit do all my heavy lifting on that stuff. I don't have time to go frame by frame through.
I,
through
too, didn't say anything about goats.
Yes. So then the last dialogue from Sissy is all great. You know, so she says there was no town before the factory. So Sissy, she has an inverse version of this where Lumen saved the town, even though the entirety of the episode, everything we've seen is telling us exactly the opposite. And then the closing dialogue between her and Cobell is so tragic and cultish and everything. Your mother was a coward, more sick in the mind than in the body. You are a weed as she was. It's like, that's what I'm talking about. Like Sissy's dialogue. I don't know the actress who played her, but like, and if we never see Sissy again, I hope we do. But if we never see Sissy again, she showed up, was just like pure brainwashed Lumenite and just nailed it for 20 minutes and then exited stage.
That's actually one of the reasons I was feeling less positive towards this episode. I get the sense all these characters that we've met, we'll never see them again. I could be wrong, but
you could be wrong, but why do we need to? Like, they're serving an important purpose here. You know, maybe Hampton dies in the confrontation with whoever's coming. And if he does, if this is all we get of Hampton, boy, does he get a great closing line, and I'll censor it, but come tame these tempers, a-holes. Like, oh, that's so good. That's so good. Okay, the last part of this episode is the phone call with Devon. She finally picks up. And I just love that. I love the tension of that we, unlike so many other episodes where I've said, we don't know when this is taking place. We know exactly when this episode is taking place. And boy, is it intense, not knowing what's going on with Mark and like Devon's calling and calling and calling. So she picks up, and I love Cobell's reaction about when she finds out they've been working with Rugabe. She hasn't killed him yet, because it was like, oh, all the things we've been pointing out aren't just little jokes from the show, because the show could have gone in that direction. Like, Rugabe actually knows what she's doing, but yet she keeps her medical supplies in a plastic crate and is toting them around.
Yeah.
It's like, based on what Cobell said, Rugabe does not know what she's doing.
I mean, she must be somewhat skilled. She worked for Lumen, but maybe she's not as skilled without the machinery. Like, she needs machines.
Rugabe has an inflated sense of her abilities. And the sense you got in that moment was, oh, Mark is this close, and I'm holding up my fingers very closely together for those listening only, to going the way of Petey because of Rugabe. Like, we didn't appreciate the danger that he was in. I was treating it as a joke, and it is funny. When she's like, I'm better at it this time. And he's like, but you've only done this once and the person died. Like, it's still funny, but there's a level of tension there that's now retroactively infused into the earlier part of the season. And then...
Before we move on from there, I had speculated that they would not call Cobell because it seems like, you know, he had woken up, maybe things were resolving. You thought, no, they're definitely going to call her. This is how she comes back on the show. Okay, so you're right there. But... Why would Mark's awake at this point. So why would he want to involve her? Unless maybe they are worried that he's dying.
We don't know what's happening though. We know he's awake, but we could come back next week and he could have been shifting in and out of realities. Yeah. Like, he could be in pretty rough shape.
So are you seeing her as all in on the good side at this point?
If I am interpreting not just the plot points, but the themes of this episode correct, Cobell is all in. And I love the way this episode ends, where Mark gets on the phone with her and we get like 2 seconds of Adam Scott's voice. Tell me everything. Cut to credits. And like the music, I don't know the song, but it's like game on. Here we go. And by the way, we didn't have the intro in this episode, but one of the pieces of symbolism is Cobell holding Mark's head in the intro. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. It's all coming together.
So next all right, week,
that's my defense of this episode.
No, I mean, I like we said at the beginning, I didn't hate it, but it definitely is my least favorite of everything we've seen so far. I'm happy to hear from you some things to appreciate more about it. And next week, penultimate episode. I mean, this is it. It's ramping up. And then, man, I hope it's just a one-year wait and not a multi-year wait again.
So I completely agree. I do think we'll get back to more of the standard plot next week, but boy, would it be funny if they just did a third side episode to mess with everybody.
Like, who could it be? Irv? I mean, no, like, he's too in. They've used two characters who are pretty much totally on the outside.
It's just Devon, or not Devon.
It's the Kier family. What if it's just the Kier family?
It's outside Dylan going through his life watching his kids.
They could do, I bet there'll be an episode someday where we see a history of those Kier CEOs.
I could see it. Totally. So my hope for people, for you and for people who are in your boat where, okay, this episode wasn't your cup of tea. Number one, anybody, not you, but anybody was coming in saying this was a bad episode. I hope I've convinced you it's not. And number two, because it's not, this was a supremely well done episode, even if, you know, you don't like the placement in the season or just didn't resonate, whatever. But I also hope for people who are in your boat that you can actually appreciate what they are doing in this episode, because it's incredibly important to the themes and the plot of the show. This is anybody who says this is a wasted episode. doesn't know what they're talking about. Like, that's just a bad opinion.
What do you think of the argument that they could have given us all of this sprinkled in throughout the season?
So, okay, I'm glad you came back to that. So I mentioned two reasons why they didn't do that. Number one was the Patricia Arquette budget thing. The other reason is that there is something about just having to sit in this world without relief. And people might not like that. That might be part of why this isn't resonating with people as much. But that, like, this, the Salt's Neck is an unpleasant place to be. This was, this is not a fun episode. And so the fact that the filmmakers are making you sit in that is thematically important. I don't think this episode is as powerful if we're getting it in 5-10 minute increments throughout the rest of the season.
Yeah. Okay. I think I see that. All right. Well, yeah, that's it. So I think that's it for this episode.
Turn that thumbs down upside down, or at least neutral, because this is not a thumbs down episode. This is another Severance masterpiece, just one that might be less accessible than so many of the others.
I could see that. All right, Ben, you've got the music, so you're going to have to hit that music.
All right.
Listeners,
I'm not good at it, everyone.
In 1 week, Ben and I will be back together face-to-face in person, so we won't have the video. But thanks for joining us here over the last few weeks as we've been virtual, and you can get these YouTube videos. And, just enjoying a great show.
I agree. 2 more weeks to go.
All right, listeners, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono.
And we're the Cyber Group. Signing off.
Bye-bye. Do you like that I kept the hat this week? My hair wasn't even that messy, but I was like, I'm a hat guy now, so I have to keep the hat.
I just assumed that your hair was messed up again, and so you just went back to the hat trick.
No, I got a haircut this week, okay. So it's in better shape. But no, I feel like now the hat's part of my video recording persona for the Sci-Fi Christian.
I love it. I have a plan, listeners. Here's a little, not spoiler, just a tease for the future. I'm going to have some sort of backdrop here eventually, make these videos really fancy, because we have some plans eventually to do more video episodes, maybe even when we're in person. So
yeah,
I think I need a backdrop other than the foundation of my house.
You get a green screen.
I don't know. I have this, you can't really see it, but over here I have sort of like a movable wall. Maybe I'll hang a sheet over it and just give myself a nice background. Right back here, if you're watching the video, this is the book poster that we always discuss in the extra feed.
Yeah.
So it's happening.
Lots of books.
All right. I'll see you, Ben.
Goodbye.
Bye, everybody.